Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, as local schools struggle to deter vaping among students, Bucks County is suing the e-cigarette maker Juul. We'll hear from Bucks County District Attorney Matthew Weintraub. Also, the use of so-called dark money in New Jersey's elections is ballooning. New Jersey State Senator Troy Singleton and Assemblyman Andrew Zwicker are pushing for the full disclosure of big donors. They will join us. But first, Pennsylvania Governor Wolf and his staff are likely putting the finishing touches on Wolf's budget address set for tomorrow. So we're going to spend a few moments talking about some of the more notable issues before the governor and the legislature. WHYY's Katie Meyer is our Harrisburg Bureau Chief, and she's back with us now for Radio Times. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
So as we've been reporting here at WHYY, at least a half dozen Philadelphia schools have been shut down, at least temporarily in recent months, because of asbestos and the remediation process. And, you know, Philly is not alone in this problem. And Governor Wolf wants to address asbestos and some other environmental hazards, Katie, in a fairly expensive proposal. Tell us more.
Sure. So this was one of the biggest proposals that Wolf has rolled out ahead of his budget address, and we're expecting it to be a part of the overall budget that we're going to see tomorrow. But he wants to use $1 billion in grants to help schools remediate lead and asbestos issues. And not just schools, but that's going to be a big part of it, especially because, as you said, we've seen this rash of closures in Philadelphia schools. So the money would come from RACP, also known as RCAP, which is a grant program that lawmakers can, you know, get pots of money and use them for municipal projects in their districts. Usually it's not used for schools, so we're going to have to see how this process plays out.
So no early reaction from Republican lawmakers?
They were very measured about it. I think, you know, it's difficult to come right out and say we don't want to fix asbestos in schools, and so maybe they will have sort of a more nuanced approach to the issue as we get into this budget negotiation process. But so they didn't comment on the merits of it. They just said that members still needed to review the plan, discuss it a little bit more, and figure out where they stand.
Okay. Governor Wolf also wants to take another crack at increasing the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big one. That has been in every single one of his budgets. This is his sixth one, so not a huge surprise there. He's pretty much asking for the exact same thing he asked for last year, which is an immediate increase of Pennsylvania's $7.50 minimum wage to $12 an hour, and then gradual increases up to $15. Republicans have never been on board with that idea. They think $12, much less $15, is way too high. We saw a little bit of movement this past year. Senate Republicans moved a $9.50 minimum wage. That was part of an agreement they had with Wolf. He was going to raise the state's overtime threshold, so you'd be able to make overtime if you make a little bit more money. That has gone before a board that has to approve those sorts of rules. Wolf had said he wouldn't do the overtime thing if the Senate and the House both passed this minimum wage increase. The House never moved on it, so he's going forward with the overtime rule. And so we're going to have to see if those negotiations budge at all. But at this point, you know, I would say be less than optimistic if you're a person who wants the higher minimum wage.
Okay. Also, we should expect to hear about a 4-year infrastructure plan. What does this entail, Katie?
This entails a whole lot of money. It is a $4.5 billion plan. It's called Restore PA. This is something Wolf rolled out last year, and it is the way it would be financed is he would get borrow money, basically bond a bunch of money, and it'd be paid back over about 20 years using specifically revenue from a new tax on the natural gas industry, a severance tax. So we would tax the oil or natural gas that comes out of the ground. We don't tax that currently in Pennsylvania. And anyway, so he wants to use that money that he's going to get up front over 4 years for a huge amount of different infrastructure stuff. So initiatives to, for instance, remediate flooding, help with blight in various communities, fix roads and bridges, all sorts of stuff. And he's gotten a lot of municipal leaders on board, a lot of county leaders. But again, Republicans in the House and Senate have not really been very amenable to it. They have
never.
They've been
pretty firm about a natural gas severance tax.
Yeah, I think that's correct. It's been a real pretty firm no.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see if that moves at all. Again, he's gonna. It's not actually technically part of the budget, but it's going to be rolled out alongside the budget.
Okay. Let's talk about human trafficking. A package of eight bills toughening laws and penalties has passed the State House. One of these measures has also been approved by the Senate, Katie. How does this affect the person who is convicted of human trafficking?
Sure. So it's, the one that already passed the Senate specifically, it gives you stricter penalties. So instead of a second-degree felony, you now get a first-degree felony, usually comes with more jail time. The other bills sort of do the same thing. So if one of them lets experts testify more frequently in human trafficking cases, that's intended to strengthen the cases against people who are doing the trafficking. One would, create new categories of crimes against minors, so that people could be accused of different things that are related to trafficking. Another one makes sure people who are connected to human traffickers don't get custody of any children, things like that. And so it is broadly, again, sort of based on increasing penalties. But there's other stuff, too. So one would expand the counseling for sex offenders in jail. So there's sort of a two-sides approach here, very heavy on the punishment side of it, but also on rehabilitation as well.
It's widely expected that these measures will become law.
It is expected, yes. So we've seen it. Again, the one that's passed the Senate, I think, might become the first bill that might be signed into law this year, actually. And then the rest of them, yeah, have pretty broad support.
Katie, let's talk about a tough story you reported on recently involving children who are born after a rape and parental rights. One might think a rapist doesn't have a claim to a child conceived during a sexual assault, but this is not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. Let's first look at the law as it stands in Pennsylvania. Tell us what a longstanding provision does provide for the survivor and about the loophole.
Sure. So this is actually, I think, a pretty little known element of the law that you read through it and you're not quite sure how it could be applied. But according to Representative Kerry Benninghoff, he's a Republican, he's sponsoring this bill. The current law, which has been on the books for like 30 years, could require the survivor of a rape who has a child as a result of that rape to have a surrogate parent, so a different parent lined up to adopt their child before they can legally eliminate the rapist's parental rights. So it's this like weird little provision that Benninghoff thinks maybe was initially intended to make sure that a child has adequate support in terms of having two parents. But, obviously there's lots of single parents out there. And so the new approach to this is just get rid of that provision. Don't require there to be a second parent lined up.
Bipartisan support for change here?
It does have bipartisan support, yeah. It passed the Judiciary Committee unanimously. We're expecting to see it come up in front of the full House pretty soon.
Okay. Overhauling Pennsylvania's redistricting laws. Legislators have been kicking this around for quite a while. Democratic Representative Steve Samuelson says legislators need to be out of the room when it comes to drawing up congressional districts. He's sponsoring legislation to that effect. Tell us more.
So this, as you indicated, has been kicking around for a long, long time. Right now, so Pennsylvania's congressional districts and House and Senate legislative districts, they're drawn different ways. So the legislature draws the congressional districts, then the governor signs off on them. It's kind of just like regular legislation. For the State House and Senate, the districts are drawn by a panel of legislative leaders, so four, one from, House Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats. Then there's a fifth outside member who's often actually appointed by the state Supreme Court. And so that is who draws the map, and then they're the ones who pass it. The governor doesn't actually have anything to do with that. So
with the State House and Senate districts, though, does that require a constitutional amendment?
If we were going to change it, yes, because that part is actually enshrined in the state constitution. The state constitution is what provides the rules for that. The congressional redistricting is not in our state constitution, so you can pass that as simple legislation. So that's what makes this whole process so complicated. So the constitutional amendment takes a long time. For anybody who doesn't know, you have to pass them with identical language in two consecutive sessions, and then the proposal has to go to voters for a referendum, a statewide referendum. They vote on it. Whatever they say ends up being added to the Constitution.
So time is of the essence, then, if you want a new map in place in time for the 2021 elections.
Exactly. And so it's getting really tight right now, and there's still not very much consensus, so it's super unclear if they're going to make the deadline that they want to. But lawmakers would need to move extremely quickly, and possibly sort of finagle maybe where they can pass the congressional redistricting first and then get that in place for 2021 and then see if they can make up time and get the amendment in place. I have talked to some people who are going to be key in passing this legislation. Garth Everett chairs the House State Government Committee. He's a Republican, and this would have to go through his committee. And he was saying, you know, he's committed to trying to consider this, seeing if they can come to some sort of a consensus. But it's not his priority to get this done for 2021.
Okay. Again, paid leave. Right now, there's no law in the books which would require employers to give their workers paid leave for vacation, illness, or other reasons, but there is a proposal before the state Senate.
There is. This is one that kind of popped up pretty recently. It is sponsored by a Republican. It would basically create a state fund. So everybody, every Pennsylvanian, every working Pennsylvanian would have a certain amount of money taken out of their paycheck, and it would go into this fund that's controlled by the state, and people would be able to pull from that if they have a legitimate reason that they need state medical or family leave, say they just gave birth, that kind of thing. So it would be, you know, pretty broad. Some other states have done stuff like this in the past, and so there is some bipartisan support for it. But again, I mean, this is like really early days. The Senate just held a hearing on it. The bill hasn't gone anywhere yet. So we're going to really have to see what happens.
Okay. To guns, a measure which has divided Democrats and Republicans would affect people convicted of committing multiple crimes with firearms. They could not serve their time concurrently, correct?
Yes.
And that has passed the State House, and a Democrat sponsored it, but most members of his caucus voted against it, Katie.
Yes, exactly. So it was a relatively moderate Democrat who sponsored it, but Tony DeLuca, he's from Allegheny County. But in any case, 73 members of his own caucus voted against it. 18 Republicans also voted against it, but it did pass. And the goal is to put people convicted of gun crimes in jail longer. And so this kind of a bill often gets lumped in with what are known as mandatory minimum sentences, those are pretty controversial. A lot of studies have been done that show they disproportionately impact people of color. And also people have done studies that show that they don't really work that well in deterring future crimes. So this is part of a larger initiative that it's mostly Republican-sponsored, although, of course, some of these bills, like this one, have Democrats behind them, too, that would seek to just make penalties harsher for specifically gun crimes and some drug crimes. And so, again, this was sort of the first of a bunch of bills that have been considered on this stuff that passed. There are more on the agenda, and they kind of do various iterations of similar sorts of things. But we're going to be following that more as those bills start moving, if they do.
All right, Katie Meyer, thanks for the update.
All right, thank you.
Katie Meyer is our State Capitol Bureau Chief for WHYY. And just ahead on Radio Times, we'll hear from New Jersey Assemblyman Andrew Zwicker and State Senator Troy Singleton about their efforts to fight dark money in state elections. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, which determined that huge amounts of money spent by special interest groups on political campaigns are a protected form of free speech. In New Jersey, some nonprofit special interest groups don't need to disclose who their big donors are. This funding is known as dark money, and there are questions and concerns about the potential dark money has to sway voters on candidates and issues. Two lawmakers, State Senator Troy Singleton and State Assemblyman Andrew Zwicker, have long been concerned about the influence of dark money spending in state politics. They say it has ballooned since the Citizens United decision. And joining us now, Andrew Zwicker, Democratic Assemblyman representing the 16th District. Good to have you with us, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
And Troy Singleton will be along in just a few moments, as I understand. So Andrew, we'll start with you. You know, why is it essential that we know who the so-called dark money donors are?
Well, Mary, you know, as you said, since Citizens United and that decision, we've seen an influx of money in our political system across the country. And in New Jersey, in the last 2 years alone, there has been over $100 million spent. And the people of New Jersey have no idea where this money has come from. The rules are such that we do not require these organizations to disclose. They have enormous influence on our political process, and I think that's wrong. I think that's not what the people of New Jersey deserve, and it is up to us as legislators to do something so that there is this shining of a light on our dark money. Mm.
Andrew Zwicker, you and Troy Singleton co-authored an op-ed that was I saw on the Star Ledger, and you write, their influence, you know, meaning that of the donors, is profound and has impacted elections at all levels of government. Let's get into that a bit. How so?
So what's happening now is that you start to look everything from a school board election to a state legislative election, a municipal election, on into the United States Congress, Senate, and President. And money is flowing in ways that we've really never seen before. So the question becomes, what do you do about it? Because the reason why this is so profound is that when you have an elected official, you want to have some sense as a just a member of the community of where is money flowing? Where is it coming from? Where is a person getting money from? What about a something that we have to vote on where we're seeing various mailings and things? I, as a state legislator, I'm required to disclose where my donations come from. And so the question becomes, why shouldn't these other organizations do the same thing?
Andrew Zwicker is Democratic Assemblyman representing the 16th District in New Jersey. And we are also joined now by Troy Singleton, a Democratic State Senator representing New Jersey's 7th Legislative District. Welcome aboard, Troy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So sure. And I'm not sure if you were able to hear anything of what Andrew just said, but we're talking about the influence of so-called dark money donors. And the influence can not only apparently impact, you know, elections and et cetera, but the outcome of public policy. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you would, Troy.
Well, Andrew summed it up incredibly well, as usual. And I think the issue that we both confronted is understanding that there are these sort of benign sounding groups who seemingly have a noble mission. But when they're affecting public policy, when they're able to put untoward sums of money into campaigns to try and trigger people to see a policy a certain way, it sort of defeats the purpose of what our elective body is all about, where we have debate, people, the citizenry can come to committees and voice their opinion, and we get to weigh the pros and cons, as it were, right then, right there, even with a little background knowledge. These other groups, these shadowy groups who are able to spend, as Andrew pointed out, an enormous amount of sums to try and confuse voters or conflate different issues sort of skews the public policy debate in our state. And I think it does a disservice to all of us who are in this to try and make sure we're doing the best public policy for the state of New Jersey.
We're talking about donors in general. Who are we talking about, Andrew? Individuals, corporations, unions, who?
So let's be clear that the legislation that Senator Singleton has in the Senate and I have in the Assembly is very particular in the types of donations that we require to be disclosed. And in particular, these are large donations, $10,000 or more. So this is not you or I, Mary, who may decide we would like to give a few hundred dollars to an organization because we support whatever the mission of that organization is. This is enormous sums of money already. And so the legislation says if you donate more than $10,000, then you have to disclose. And often what we're seeing is it's not tens of thousands, but it's millions of dollars that are coming into these organizations.
That are flowing into groups, nonprofits like, say, the ACLU or the right-leaning Americans for Prosperity. Could you tell us a little bit more about the groups that we're talking about and the donors who are then perhaps, you know, spending millions to support these groups' causes?
So the types of organizations, go across the political spectrum. They are everything from what might be a right-leaning group to a politically right to politically left. An environmental group on one hand, a anti-environmental group on the other. There's no political partisanship to this whatsoever. And so what we're seeing, and we don't know the answer more often than not to where this money comes from, because it's dark money, because they are not required to disclose. So unless one of these organizations voluntarily discloses, we can't answer the question of where that money is coming from.
Okay, so hypothetically, if we'll just take, say, the ACLU, and maybe the ACLU wants to run ads about a particular topic. If there's somebody who is a billionaire who is disclosing, you know, way over the 10,000 mark, say a couple million dollars, then that money buys that many more TV and radio ads to kind of put that topic before the public. Correct, Troy?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
And I think to Andrew's point, that's why we'd like to be able to know who's putting money into these ads and frankly, into these ads and public policy pressure campaigns, because the citizenry should have an idea whether or not their elected officials have been influenced by any particular sources of revenue that are not disclosed. As Andrew said early on, all of us as elected officials, he, I, and the other 118 of us in the New Jersey legislature have to file reports that dictate who gives us money and why. And our voters are able to make a determination whether or not we've been influenced in their mind by said contribution. In this instance, we don't know who's putting money in, and we don't know what their motives are. And they hide behind these benign sounding names. And in turn, they're skewing public policy in a way sometimes to the detriment of the majority of the residents of New Jersey.
Okay. Andrew, as you mentioned earlier, you and Troy co-authored legislation. I think is it S-150 in the Senate, which took aim at dark money, signed into law last year, and is now hung up in the courts. In issuing an injunction last fall, federal judge Brian Martinotti found a likelihood that the dark money law would be found unconstitutional. If he's referring to Citizens United, does free speech include anonymous donation, in your opinion?
So this gets to the heart of the matter. And the lawsuit in front of the judge has two components, one related to free speech and one related to whether or not someone can stay anonymous. But it seems to me, and I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that we are in a place now where our democratic principles are, and I don't think it's grandiose to say, our very democracy is being threatened by special interests where the people do not have a say or an understanding of where this money's coming from. And so, it is paramount that we do everything we can to shine a light on this dark money. So we are waiting, of course, on the courts to make a ruling, but this issue is literally that important, and it's why Troy and I have been working so hard on it.
Troy, just wanted you to weigh in on that. Dark money, free speech, anonymous donation. What do you think?
Well, I fundamentally disagree with the overarching decision of Citizens United. I think, and it's been borne out, that the decision has led to such an influx of money into our body politic that is getting harder and harder to actually have the bandwidth to have a good policy discussion and make intelligent decisions as far as the electorate goes with respect to these political issues. But as it relates to the work that Andrew and I have done, as he pointed out, there's no seek of partisanship in what we're doing. We don't try and choose the ACLU because they may agree with our principles, maybe more so than Americans for Prosperity. We believe every group, no matter whether they're Democratic leaning or Republican leaning, should be held to the same standard of disclosure, because it is skewing our body politics so greatly. And this idea of money being so pervasive in our electoral process right now, as Andrew said, it tears at the very fabric of our democracy if we don't have a greater sense of transparency. And that's what we've been fighting for and will continue to.
Andrew Zwicker, not sure you have the answer to this, but we've got a question from one of our listeners, Joe, who asks, what about dark money being spent by pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey like Merck?
So if I understand the question, it's not about from Joe. It's not about a particular corporation, right? It is about an organization that does not have to disclose. And to be clear, and this is lost often in the discussion of the legislation that was signed by Governor Murphy and authored by Senator Singleton and myself, corporations do have to disclose. So again, this is about disclosure for all. And it's not about one particular corporation or one particular industry. It's not about politically left or politically right. You know, it seems to me that everybody is for disclosure until they have to disclose. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, they seem to be against it. But I think Troy really got to the heart of this issue, is that disclosure is good for our democracy overall.
Troy, nonprofits, some of them, say that if they reveal big donors, the donors might receive backlash. And federal Judge Martinotti acknowledged this in his opinion, writing, "We are in a, quote, climate marked by the so-called cancel or call-out culture that's resulted in people losing employment, being ejected or driven out of restaurants while eating their meals, and where the Internet removes any geographic barriers to cyber harassment of others. How do we address these concerns and achieve transparency in the election process, Troy?"
Well, I think broadly, those issues and those challenges are ones that we have faced, not just in this environment where it's just become a little bit more heightened, but I think throughout our time. I think the original decision going back years and years ago to the Civil Rights Movement, where this conversation point came in, was whether or not individuals who had been helping the NAACP and other organizations at that time should have to be disclosed. And it became an issue because literally their lives were on the line for trying to ensure that everyone had access to the same rights and responsibilities and privileges that all of us. I think as we look at right now, the sort of environment and culture we're in, while yes, it is heightened, and I think your words you used, the cancel culture, as it were. But that being said, if we are to have full disclosure and full transparency in our electoral process, we have to press on and do that. And secondarily, for those individuals who seek to utilize someone's political donations as a means for cyber harassment or bullying, or try and in turn get someone to lose their job, I think they will find two allies in Andrew and I to be in a position to sort of call those individuals out for trying to use scare tactics to keep our democracy in the shadows. It's something that we need to continue to fight and guard against, but we cannot allow that to be the sort of reasoning and rationale behind why we're going to allow these amorphous groups, as I said, with benign-sounding names, to completely pervert our electoral process. We just can't allow it.
Andrew, you are a nuclear physicist at Princeton University and an environmentalist, but you suffered some fallout politically for S-150 when the New Jersey League of Conservation Voters decided to pull its endorsement. The executive director of the LCV says if you care about climate change, you have to care about the role that the nonprofit community plays. How do you respond to that?
So I remain one of the highest rated environmentalists in the New Jersey legislature. I will continue to do everything I can to work for clean air, clean water, and against climate change for the people of New Jersey, regardless of the political blowback that I've received. While it's true that the League of Conservation Voters chose not to endorse me over this particular issue, the Sierra Club and every other organization in New Jersey, environmental organization, endorsed me. And I, right before this phone call, was at a conference talking about how do we get to an eventual place where we produce, we consume no fossil fuels. So, you know, it really comes down to where this conversation started before, which is, it doesn't matter to us whether we agree or disagree with a particular policy position that an organization has chosen. What we care about is disclosure. And so the question becomes, what is it that people do not want to disclose? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know where these donations come from. But I will continue to fight with alongside Troy, regardless of the political blowback, to get this done, because the people of New Jersey deserve to know where this money is coming from.
You have introduced a so-called cleanup bill. What would it do?
It depends. The cleanup bill, we have two versions, and it depends on the ruling of the judge. The judge can choose to allow the law to go through as is, can strike down the entire law, or can strike down a part of the law. And so the cleanup bills that we have, the area that is perhaps the most concern has to do not with dark money influencing our elections, but how it's used to influence particular pieces of legislation or a regulation. There is some indication that that is where the judge is most concerned. And if so, we have cleanup legislation that would either look at how we could require disclosure around legislation, regulation, when it's being influenced, or we could remove that entirely. But until the judge rules, we're going to just wait to see what happens.
Okay. Troy Singleton, we've got about 30, 40 seconds left here. In the meantime, as the process works itself out, how would you advise New Jerseyans about the best ways to gather and consider information about candidates and issues?
So I will always say to go right to the candidates first and foremost and the elected officials and ask their positions directly is always going to be the way to get the most honest, sincere and point in time answer. I think folks should be judicious in the information they consume, because now, you know, there's a lot of folks trying to influence people by sort of moving about and sort of changing the narrative. But first and foremost, always, and I know Andrew believes in this because I've been with him as he's been out at public events and talking to the citizenry we all represent, is to just engage your elected officials directly, ask their opinions on the tough and easy issues, and seek their positions, and ultimately use that as your guide as you determine who you're supporting and why. Don't give, as we like to say, don't give the pen of your life story to someone else to write.
All right. State Senator, New Jersey State Senator Troy Singleton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we appreciate it as well. New Jersey Assemblyman Andrew Zwicker, thank you.
Thank you, Mary, for having us.
All right. Just ahead on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, Bucks County is suing Juul. We'll talk to a District Attorney Matt Weintraub. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Cummings Jordan. Last week on one of the evening news shows, there was a story about a 17-year-old from Michigan who was the first person to undergo an emergency double lung transplant after his lungs were irreversibly damaged by vaping. The operation was necessary to save his life. One of the more striking aspects of the story, however, regards his twin brother. Despite everything that's happened, the brother still vaped because he is addicted to nicotine. The vaping crisis, of course, has hit home here in the Delaware Valley as well. And also last week, we learned that Bucks County District Attorney Matthew Weintraub is suing the e-cigarette maker Juul and a New Jersey-based company which makes flavored pod products, Eon Smoke. Weintraub joins us now to tell us more about how this epidemic has affected Bucks County and what he expects to gain from the lawsuit. Matthew Weintraub, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
Other stories, other news stories, notably political, have been grabbing the headlines recently. But for young people who find themselves addicted to nicotine through vaping, the emergency, Matthew, continues. And even as it's estimated that about a quarter of all high schoolers across Pennsylvania have vaped, you say Bucks County is, quote, tragically among the leaders, that the rate of Bucks teens who vape is even higher than 25%?
That's true. I think it's ranking somewhere in 37%, and that's according to the PAYS survey, the most recent one that we have data from, in which teens self-report. And I think that this is obviously an alarming trend that we need to reverse right away.
What do you allege Juul has done to encourage vaping among minors?
Juul explicitly targets minors with their advertising. They do so through the social media campaign. They do so through models that look and sound like teens want to look and sound. And they also do so, or they had done so before they stopped recently, by using flavors such as gummy bear, cotton candy, things that would clearly appeal to a younger set.
So you're saying Juul knew what it was doing when it came out with cool vaping devices and fun flavors.
This is clearly targeting the young market. Were it not, they wouldn't have to use such targeted advertising. And that's why we're trying to go after them directly, because they've created the new epidemic. Now these kids are already hooked. And for some, hopefully it's not too late, but it may be.
When we say minors, Matthew Weintraub, how young are we talking?
Well, the law, I think, recently was changed to mimic cigarette products. So you have to be over 21 to or 21 or over to purchase vape products. But really, our lawsuit is targeting anybody that has been impacted that's under the age of 18, because they're our children. They're the ones that we, frankly, have a responsibility for, and that have been deemed under the law to not have personal responsibility themselves if they've been targeted and getting hooked in this way.
So when we think about the vaping crisis in young people, quite often we think high schoolers, but I'm hearing that there are children younger than high schoolers who are also involved.
Yeah, it's not just hearsay and word of mouth. We've seen evidence of this fact. We did actually hear from the head nurse at Central Bucks West High School, but she has reported that she's also hearing this from the middle schools as well. And I was speaking with a teacher the other day. He says any time he walks into a restroom at one of the local high schools, he's catching a vapor or he is seeing the after effects of somebody that had just vaped.
You're speaking, I think, of Carol Klein, the nurse with the Central Bucks School District. And she appeared at last week's news conference with you. And yeah, Matt Weintraub, she really put a personal face on this situation as someone who works so closely with young people. Here's some of what she had to say. Some students have admitted to vaping up to 60 times a day. There are kids who secretly vape in class, apparently not hard to do. Others have had seizures and high blood pressure from ingesting so much nicotine and have needed emergency treatment. So, you know, as the district attorney, how would you characterize what she had to say?
It's disturbing. I have two children of my own. I have two daughters of my own. And this is just one more thing that as a parent I have to be concerned and worried about for my kids and for the kids all over Bucks County. I learned something when the nurse was speaking at the press conference about something called ghosting, in which the students will actually vape right in the classroom, and rather than exhale that now all too familiar puff of vapor, they'll keep it in their lungs and just ingest it. And I have to imagine that's got to be terrible for a person's body.
There is a higher risk for nicotine addiction with e-cigarettes than with traditional cigarettes?
Well, that I'm not certain of, but I know that it is addicting people left and right, certainly here in Bucks County and all over the country. And what I think, Mary, is that there is just less of a stigma. We've done a pretty great job as a culture and a country in stigmatizing cigarette smoking, certainly among minors, so that those rates have gone down to a historical low. But the same stigma just does not exist in the vape culture, and that's because of the advertising that Juul has done, and now Eon Smoke has jumped up to replace them in the flavored pod business.
Mm. Carol Klein also points out that one pod of a vaping product equals an entire pack of cigarettes, and that some students are going through multiple pods every day, and they do not believe, you know, there's any danger to this. I want to get back to something that we talked about just a little bit earlier, Matthew Weintraub, and that's the fact that the rate of kids who vape in Bucks County is higher than across the state of Pennsylvania. Do you know why this might be, say, 37% as opposed to 25% across the state?
I can only imagine that the Juul's advertising was much more effective here, whether that's because they were more effective in getting to the peer influencers, the thought leaders in that peer group of the young people, or whether there's just more availability here. As you know, we also sued two specific locations that were caught by the Food and Drug Administration at selling vapes to younger people, and that's the Gulf Mart in Quakertown and Delta Gas in Warminster. And so if we've already We've already specifically identified two. This is something that we need to crack down on and do a better job on.
Mm-hmm. The marketing technologies that make vaping products appealing, you say they are deceptive business practices which broke the law. Can you get that into that a little bit for us?
Absolutely. Juul on one hand says that they are not marketing to young people specifically, but their actions tell us an entirely different and opposite story. In addition, they say that vaping is a safe alternative to cigarette smoking. And we know that now not to be the case. As of October of 2019, more than 1,000 lung injuries have been reported nationwide as a result of the use of e-cigarettes, and we've experienced 26 deaths across the country, including one here in Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, that number may grow before we can get a handle on this, but I, for one, want to make sure that Juul and Eon Smoke are held accountable for the damage that they've wrought on our young people.
We are speaking with Matthew Weintraub, District Attorney for Bucks County. Is the lawsuit seeking a particular dollar amount?
No, I don't think that is calculable yet, Mary. The issue is we're still learning about the damages, the untold damages. If a person, for example, a young person gets hooked on vapes because of the nicotine at age 12, hopefully, I hope and pray they lead a long life. But if they're addicted for the rest of their life, we don't know how much damage that's going to occur. I can tell you that one of my goals is to make sure that we win enough damages so that I can put a vapor detector in every school, in every bathroom, in every school in Bucks County, and we have many, many schools here.
So there is such a technology that's available that is in existence now, a vapor detector?
That is correct, and they are costly, as you can imagine, but that's one of my very concrete goals.
Go ahead.
To the point, Mary, what I'd like to do is to be able to analyze the problem to see the extent of the damage, and we'll need to do studies and research on that. But I also want to be able to provide health recourse and remedies for these young people that are now unwittingly addicted to a product they never intended to be addicted to. As you said, the nurse stated that some of these kids are vaping as many as 60 times a day. And that's just unprecedented.
Mm. Well, and yeah, back to the TV report we were talking about at the top of the segment, the young man with a double lung transplant, he's 17 years old. The report showed him holding a plastic bag full of pill bottles. He has to take apparently 20 pills a day, every day for the rest of his life, so his new lungs aren't rejected by his body. His twin brother is still vaping nicotine products. You can imagine their mother is distraught about this. So is there, at this point, enough of a treatment infrastructure in place in Bucks County that you might know of, Matthew Weintraub, to help people at least get started in trying to kick the vaping habit?
There is, and I would recommend if somebody is looking for specific information about how to kick the habit or where to go for resources, at least in Bucks County, that's through my partner, Bucks County Drug and Alcohol Commission. And they can be contacted on their website, bcdac.org. They're a wonderful organization. Most of what they do is free of charge. And their whole goal is just having us be a healthy community, a community that is not addicted to these insidious drugs like nicotine.
Montgomery County District Attorney Kevin Steele filed a similar lawsuit in November. And he appeared with you during your press conference last week. Is it rare for you to team up like this?
No. We enjoy a great relationship, Kevin Steele and I. And to give credit where it's due, he filed this lawsuit before I did and gave me the idea. So I certainly wanted to share the credit with Kevin and make sure that we posed a united front to show Juul Labs and Eon Smoke that we are not messing around.
Also, a number of local school districts, I think you mentioned earlier, are filing e-cigarette lawsuits, including Quakertown, Neshaminy. How is Bucks County coordinating with them, if at all?
I've been in contact with their attorney, and I want to make sure that we provide them whatever resources and information that we can, because I do think that there's strength and power in numbers. And hopefully what we're going to do is to get Juul Labs and now Eon Smoke to submit, to admit that they had this plan to hook our youngsters, our minors, and to pay for it, to pay for the damage that they've wrought. So I think that the more the better.
Have you heard from Juul, Eon Smoke, and the retailers?
Strikingly, I have not, Mary, but I would love to speak to them and see what they plan to do about this crisis that they've created.
In a statement, Juul says it remains focused on resetting the vapor category in the U.S. and earning the trust of society by working cooperatively with local officials, regulators, public health officials, and others. Matthew Weintraub, in your opinion, can vaping be reset, and can Juul earn the trust of society by working with local officials to help combat underage use?
I hope that their agenda can and will be reset, because up till this point, they've targeted minors. They've targeted children as their segment that they want to sell to. So if it's reset and vaping can be an alternative to smoking for adults, that's fine with me. An adult has that prerogative. But the first step is Juul and Eon Smoke have to acknowledge what they've done and the damage that they've wrought so that they can help us pay for that and make sure that we have a healthy community here, at least in Bucks County and Montgomery County.
In November, Juul did stop the sale of flavored pods other than tobacco and menthol and ended, you know, a lot of its advertising. But that's not, I'm going to guess that that's not enough of a first step, in your opinion.
It is a first step, but what I would note, and this is why we joined Eon Smoke in this lawsuit, is as soon as Juul stopped with the flavored pods, Eon Smoke saw an opportunity to make a lot of money by filling that breach. So there was no disruption in the flavored pod market, and that's one of the issues. We need this to stop being marketed to our children, and I don't care who it is, whether it's Juul or Eon Smoke, it just has to stop, full stop, period.
Juul, at least at one point, was worth billions. How does Bucks County go up against a corporate giant?
It's like that age-old adage, how do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time.
That's right. So we're taking a shot here. I admit that it is somewhat novel, but I am undaunted. If they want to take the fight to us, that's what we do for a living, Mary. We are not intimidated by larger opponents, and I plan to see this through to the end, and at least until I get a settlement that satisfies me that I could distribute some of the restitution that we receive across a broad spectrum of services to try to help our children that have been preyed upon by these giants, as we call them.
If the county does not prevail, are taxpayers on the hook at all for this?
Great question. No. The law firm that we engaged for this lawsuit is doing this on a purely contingency basis. There will be no tax dollars, zero tax dollars expended, win, lose, or draw.
So what happens next in the legal process, Matthew Weintraub?
Well, that's a great question, Mary. Unfortunately, as you know, we've filed an aggressive lawsuit here, but now it's up to Juul Labs and Eon Smoke to respond and react. I'm hoping they do so quickly, but that's really out of my hands right now, and it's in the hands of the litigators to the lawsuit.
So it could take a while, years maybe.
Yes, I think we should buckle our seatbelts and get ready for what could be a bumpy ride, although I hope we get to our destination, and that is payback from these companies.
Okay, and so we've got about 20 seconds left. As the lawsuit is winding its way through the system, how does Bucks County make a dent in vaping among young people?
It's got to come through awareness and conversation. Parents need to talk to their kids about the dangers of vaping. It is not a safe alternative for children to smoking.
All right, Matthew Weintraub, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary, for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Keep us posted. Matthew Weintraub is Bucks County's district attorney. And as always, we invite you to join us on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.